If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 29th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today here in Stanford, in Hoover's recording studio deep in the heart of the Stanford University campus, is Ben Domenech. Ben Domenech is the publisher of the online magazine The Federalist, host of the Federalist Radio Hour, and writes The Transom, a daily subscription newsletter for political insiders. Ben previously was a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a senior fellow at the Heartland Institute, and he's also a recovering speechwriter. He once wrote speeches for HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson and Texas Senator John Cornyn. Ben Domenech's writing has appeared in The Wall Street Journal, The Daily Beast, Politico, Commentary, Reason, and GQ. He also appears regularly on Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, and Face the Nation, which is on CBS. And Ben, it's exhausting just reading that. How do you find the time to do all that?
Well, you didn't have to read all of it, but I certainly appreciate it. I find the time by sleeping as little as possible.
Very good. How many individuals right now are crossing the, like in Ghostbusters, crossing the streams? They're doing Fox News and MSNBC and CNN. How many of you are out there?
Well, I will admit that I do CNN less than I do the others, though I do like it when I get a chance to do it. I personally have been on contract with CBS for the past couple of years, mm-hmm. so I've done less crossing the streams. But recently, in fact, I've sort of broadened things out, and in the last 6 months, done Fox, CNN, and CBS. I usually do the Sunday show thing of Fox News Sunday and CBS about twice a month, and I think that's about enough of me on TV. I'm not exactly a TV-first person, to be honest.
Somebody who is very good on television is your colleague, the Federalist, Molly Hemingway.
Yes.
Question, Ben, why is Molly Hemingway not the White House press secretary?
Well, I'll be honest. It's because she doesn't like politicians that much. I'm sure if she wanted the job, she might be able to get it. But the funny thing about that, of course, is that Molly, prior to joining us at The Federalist, when we launched a little more than 5 years ago, had done no cable news at all and actually had kind of been an anti-TV person.
Really?
It's pretty amazing that you have... I think that cable news has a certain image, particularly of the type of women who they like to put on. And Molly is someone who stands out, I think, in the field as being someone who is respected by her colleagues and taken very seriously for an acute wit and a very sort of fiercely logical approach to things.
I'm promoting her for that job, Ben, not because I dislike Sarah Sanders, but that Molly is really a good jouster, and it seems to me that they need a jouster in that White House press. Yeah, it's a thankless job. It may be a hopeless job in many respects, so probably not since Ron Ziegler in the Nixon White House as a press secretary had this bad of a hand dealt to them. But I could just see her easily up on that and just kind of giving as good as she gets.
One of the things that I think she does better than almost anyone in the business, and maybe better than all of them, is she doesn't necessarily accept the premise of what someone is coming at her with. Uh-huh. She questions in a way that responds to the weaknesses of their argument. And I think that, frankly, that's what we should have in a White House press secretary, is someone who, when the media is attempting to sort of do the type of grandstanding, which most recently CNN's Jim Acosta in his forthcoming book admits that he does, neutrality is an approach that he ought to use. I think that, the press secretary has an obligation to sort of stand up there and to take that kind of heat thrown at them. But they can also respond in kind.
Yeah, I think we hit bottom the other day. You actually put this on your Twitter account. I was going through it this morning. And Nicole Wallace on MSNBC was interviewing Beto O'Rourke. And she asked him point blank, how can we better cover your campaign?
it's funny because here's the thing. There's plenty of people in the industry and people who are in it know the differences between them, who are very professional and who take their jobs very seriously. But there are also people within the industry who, are ideologues first. And unfortunately, I think we've reached a point where there used to be a distinction between those who came on TV to offer their opinion and those who came on to report straight news, as straight as they could offer it. Yeah. And I think now that now in the minds of the American people, one of the reasons that the media has diminished so much is that all of these things are lumped into the media, the quote-unquote media, and that there is no longer a distinction. And, you know, frankly, I think the problem is that there are still people out there, people like Nicole Wallace, people like Chris Cuomo, who go on air and pretend that they're giving you straight news when the reality is that they're no different from the type of Fox News hosts that they routinely criticize, who are opinion makers and opinion holders and lead with those opinions.
So explain to me where the Federalist and your podcast fit into this great spectrum of media that we have today.
Well, the Federalist was begun, as I said, 5 years ago. I co-founded it with Sean Davis, who is formerly a longtime staffer for Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, and in addition to that, served as the CFO of the Daily Caller when it launched. And so we sort of connected together in a sort of simpatico ideology. He's a little more of a traditional conservative, while I'm more libertarian. And we wanted to start up a publication that would speak to the politics of the times. And one of the things that we really saw on the center right was, and keeping in mind this is you know 6 years ago, the absence really of voices that were built to challenge what we thought of as the critical element of our times. The National Review was built, obviously, with the help of Herbert Hoover to win the Cold War. And it did so, I would argue, over the course of the next coming decades, fueling the campaigns of Barry Goldwater and of Ronald Reagan and influencing the ideas of Richard Nixon and of other key leaders who ended up reaching a point where the Berlin Wall would come down. I think the Weekly Standard was founded really to win the minds over of those who were working through what came after the Cold War, and the ideas that came out of that publication flowed for both good and for ill into the George W. Bush administration. It affected a lot of the policies that were there. But we felt like the real critical battle of the times coming out of the 2012 election was the culture war, and that there needed to be a publication that spoke to those demands and did so with a group of voices that were younger, more diverse, and particularly more feminine, in the sense that we wanted to build a publication, and we have, that is majority millennial in its staffing and majority female. And because of that, we have a lot more readership that is female. It's almost 40%, which is pretty much unheard of in terms of a political publication to have that level of female readership. It tends to skew younger, more Gen X, more people who are engaging in politics, not necessarily having come up with the same ideas that flowed out of the baby boom generation and into the conservative movement. So we kind of view our position within the firmament of the right, which now includes many publications of a vastly larger number than when I was starting out interning at Human Events. it is, I think, a good thing to have so many diverse voices, but our space within it really is speaking to culture first. It's why we end up having, as many articles that look at, the key lessons that can be drawn out of premier TV and HBO, or out of music and lessons concerning, not just pop culture, but society, relationships, education, child rearing, all of those different things that are part of a constant battle and, frankly, lead into the type of politics that we have as a nation.
Right. So you divide your time between D.C. and New York.
Yes.
New York is where your lovely wife is, right?
Yes.
And we'll
get
to her in a few minutes. If you were in New York, though, and let's put this in a New York context for you, the late Ed Koch, Mayor Koch, famous for going down to the subway stations and going to the bowels of the subway system and going up to his constituents and asking the question, how am I doing?
Mm.
So let's put you, Ben, into a New York subway stop and Donald Trump approaches you. Good question, by the way. The last time Donald Trump rode a New York subway.
I would be curious
as
to the
answer. He's been in the back of
that.
Cars for the better part of 30 or 40 years.
That being said, so has Bill de Blasio.
Exactly.
So.
I mean, they're overland and subterranean Manhattanites, and I think Trump is in the overland category. But if Trump came up to you, Ben, and said, how am I doing, what would you tell him?
I would say that I think on foreign policy, I think he's been impressive. certainly far more than I expected him to be necessarily when he started out. I quibble a little bit with a few of the moves that he's made, but I think there he's done very well. I think on the judiciary, I think he's doing very well. He has a transactional approach that turns out he honors when it comes to the deals that he's made along those lines. I would say when it comes to domestic policy, I think he's leaving a lot on the table, particularly when it comes to the education space. I would like to see him lean a lot more into reform within that area, not just for K through 12, but for higher education as well. I think the Department of Education is kind of leaving a lot on the table, though I do agree with their stances when it comes to rolling back some of the Obama interpretations on Title IX and, and elsewhere. I think the tax bill, largely a creation of the Republican Congress, was well done for the most part. I think you can quibble with some aspects of it again, but I think it's no different than what a tax bill would have looked like under a lot of different presidencies. I think that the defects of his administration are, you know, largely due to the people that he has chosen for some positions that I think turned out to be unwise. Ironically, some of those were hailed at the time as being relatively pragmatic or were advised by people who are really respected. We forget.
Such as what, Jeff Sessions?
Well, I think I would include three of his most prominent picks in that number. And it pains me to say this, but I think Jeff Sessions, Rex Tillerson, and unfortunately Jim Mattis turned out to be the wrong picks for those jobs. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Tillerson, he was recommended by people as respected as Bob Gates and others who'd worked with him. But I think he was a man who was really profoundly unused to the constraints of government and the things that he would have to do in that job. I think Jeff Sessions was possibly the worst pick in every respect, not just for what came out of that for the Republicans in losing that Alabama Senate seat, but also because I think Sessions is someone who was unused to the job requirements of that, reacted badly to a couple of different situations, and also turned out to be the greatest hedge against criminal justice reform, which the president is now trumpeting as being, you know, a wonderful aspect of his administration. That sort of thing would have happened a lot earlier without Jeff Sessions in the picture. And then when it came to Mattis, I think that Mattis is someone who, you know, clearly is a American hero, someone who has served the country well in so many different jobs, but also was not necessarily the right person for that position, in part because I think he was unwilling to really go out there and view the role in the necessary PR capacity that every cabinet officer has to occupy these days. And it's why we ended up with situations where, unfortunately, you know, the lessons, the first stories that Americans got out of, for instance, this, the recent situations in Africa were negative stories, because the positive stories that they were telling about what they were doing in terms of battling Boko Haram and others were not something that Mattis was interested in sharing. That's something that I think, you know, if you could, it's ironic because, well, it's not ironic. It's ahistorical to have a president whose sort of second round of cabinet choices end up being better than the first round.
Right.
But I think that you could say that really in this as circumstances in a number of different capacities. I certainly think that Attorney General Barr is doing a better job of serving the president than Jeff Sessions did.
Let's talk about a funny disconnect I find with this presidency, Ben, and that is if you look at models of the 2020 election, Ray Fair, for example, the Yale economist, does his model, and I think right now he says Trump is going to win and Trump's going to get 56% of the vote. Would you like to wager Donald Trump getting 56% of the vote?
I would not put money on that.
It's not going to happen.
Well, let's put it this way. If he ever gets up to 56%, he'll find a way to make it interesting.
Exactly. But yeah, 56%, if you cut California, Massachusetts, and New York and Illinois out of the equation, yeah, 56 is doable, but not likely. But you look at the Fair model, then you look at the Quinnipiac poll that came out last week, which showed, 71% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the economy. Hasn't been that high in like 18 years. This guy should be on a pretty good path for reelection. But you look at his numbers when asked individually about the economy, asked individually about foreign policy, asked individually about his persona, his numbers are weak. Mm-hmm. So how do you assess these two? So it seems to me that on the one hand, Ben, he at all times, his personality is going to be a drag. On the other hand, you can argue that without that personality, he probably doesn't get this job in the first place. So, you know,
that,
what do we do moving forward with Donald Trump?
Well, you know, I think that I'm glad that you added that last bit, because I think people forget it. This president does not become president without that personality.
Right.
It's an aggressive personality, one that is very confrontational, that does not abide any slight, that punches back and punches back hard to anything right. that he perceives as being an attack. And that's something people are not used to in a president in the modern era.
Yes.
It's happened in the past more than once, but we have mm-hmm. not seen it in the era of the immediacy of social media and everything that comes from that. What I find to be really difficult to understand at this juncture is it seems to me that Democrats facing a circumstance where the economy is against them, where they essentially have to bet on a collapse or some kind of international conflagration to raise the possibilities on paper of winning the White House, that they need to, I think, instead hone in on the idea that this is an extremely abnormal presidency in the modern era, and that a lot of Americans, even those who supported the president or maybe even voted for him, tire of the high blood pressure that happens right. On a regular basis that comes out of this White House. I think that can be exaggerated a little bit, but that seems to me that the way to approach this election, to say, look, the economy's going well, we don't want to disrupt it. You know, on foreign policy, we want to change some things to make, conflagrations, war less likely. But overall, what we want is a return to normalcy, a return to the presidency as you knew it. Instead, Democrats, thanks to their progressive base and their donor class to a certain extent, are being pushed and prodded into impeaching the president.
Yes.
Something that I think has always been the case about this midterm. You know, I said it was an impeachment election last year, and I think that that's always been the case. And now it's just a question of whether Nancy Pelosi can keep the sort of left side of the equation at bay, because from my perspective, if they go down that road of impeaching this president, they lose entirely the argument that they can make mm-hmm. and that their current most popular candidate, Joe Biden, could make about returning to normalcy, because that clearly is not what they would represent.
One thing I'm interested in, Ben, is if they decide to go down the path of impeachment, the time frame in doing so. I went back and looked at 1998, the last time we went through this episode, and it all works pretty fast. Clinton testifies in August. Early September, the Starr report comes out, and they begin the inquiry in early October. The House votes in December, then on to the Senate trial. So that's, just a few months. It's pretty quick, especially in Washington time. I don't know if this House is that organized, because one thing about the Starr report that the Mueller report did not do, the Starr report gave them, I believe, 11 identifiable places to go impeach the guy. It's sort of like saying, I'm not going to invite you into my vault to take my money, but here are 11 possible combinations that'll get you in the vault. The Starr report does not give them that path. And Mueller was out today actually kind of further affirming that he personally did not want to hang the guy. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, Ben, as to if the Democrats, if it's in their best interest to try to get this thing done this fall, or do you wait till next spring? But if you do it this fall, it steps right on top of the Democratic primaries and caucuses, and impeachment becomes part of a large conversation about the 2020 candidates.
I think you've identified a real core problem that Nancy Pelosi is well aware of, right. which is that, look, they made a big show early on of saying we are going to continue these investigations, but we also want to get some legislation done. We're willing to do, an infrastructure deal. We're willing to do some of these other things that the president has proffered, and that seemed to be something that was truly possible. I think, unfortunately, for Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team, we should keep in mind her leadership team has stuck with her through all of this, including Steny Hoyer, including Sherry Bustos. And they have all been at this sort of a united front saying, no, we're not going to do impeachment. That would be a political mistake. The problem is that Jerry Nadler has broken with that, clearly seems to be indicating that he's in favor of things.
Right.
And one of the things that affects this whole conversation is that process and is the timing. Because what Nancy Pelosi knows is that by going down this impeachment road, she eliminates any ability for Democrats to run next fall on anything other than impeachment, because they won't have achieved anything. They won't have anything to point to. And if you're pointing to, we impeached the guy for something that it's difficult for us to explain in terms of the obstruction charge, that's something that I think a lot of Americans will be frustrated with, particularly if, as I expect, impeachment increases the level of potential for civic violence, for confrontation between, you know, fellow Americans who mm-hmm. have, you know, very different views on this subject. It increases the likelihood of you know, market uncertainty, and Democrats will have the accusation that they're throwing a good economy into you know, a bad situation. And I think it really is something that the president has decided is actually in his own best interest. I think he has goaded them somewhat into this situation. All of that to say, I think that, you know, we have to keep in mind the Senate does have to take this up. You know, they, if you send over impeachment articles, it's not something that Mitch McConnell can just sort of shove aside. They're obligated to take those up and actually have a trial.
Well, I thought, Ben, there had been some different interpretations about that.
Yes, but I am very much of the view that they actually have to.
Well, my take would be, why wouldn't you? Because, look, you do the math in the Senate. It takes, 67 votes to convict?
Yeah.
There are 47 votes to hang him right now. You've got to pick off 20 Republicans?
No, it's not going to happen.
Look at what states they come from. They come from serious Trump states. He's going to walk.
And if you can imagine the timing on this playing out, let's say that Nancy Pelosi successfully delays this for a couple of months, just saying no, holding to her no, then you're talking about a situation where this could be happening as those initial votes are happening to select the Democratic nominee.
Right.
And keep in mind, of those senators you're talking about, seven of those Democratic senators are currently running to be the nominee in 2020.
Right.
And will take every opportunity to try to grandstand on this issue and make themselves the most anti-Trump candidate. Personally, I think that this is a situation where it will hurt the Democratic Party's interests overall, and they've been forced into something that Nancy Pelosi, who I think is a very smart individual, the best leader that they've had in the in the modern era, I would say, even arguably better than some who get maybe some more praise. The Pelosi has held her ship together to this point, but now I think she's losing control.
Interesting. So let's talk about the 2020 Democrats. Trump did something I thought rather interesting in 2016, Ben. He broke what I call the cycle of politics of pathos. If you go back to 1988, the elder Bush runs for president. The submarine rescue, shot down and rescued by a submarine, it's a part of the campaign, but it's on the film of the convention, and it shows up in some campaign ads, but it's not at the core of his running for president. You know, I survived, you know, getting shot down by the Japanese, and so I should be your president. He doesn't make that part of his story. He also doesn't make his daughter's death from leukemia, young Robin Bush. He doesn't make that central to his mission, if you will. In 1992, Bill Clinton comes along, and I know this personally because I worked on the 92 campaign for Bush, and we lost, and we couldn't get this. Clinton changes things. Mm-hmm. And now he and Al Gore, a couple of 40-something guys, talking openly about not being able to please their parents, and Clinton not knowing his biological father. It becomes very much a People magazine kind of effort. Then we go to 2000 with George W. Bush, and his kicking the bottle becomes a big part of his narrative. We go to 2008 with Barack Obama, and it's the laments and struggles of a man who is biracial and trying to figure out where he fits in the world. Then along comes Donald Trump in 2016, and there's not an ounce of pathos to be found anywhere. It's just the opposite. It's bragging about greatness, about how terrific he is. But now we look at the 2020 field, Ben, and you went up to New Hampshire recently and followed these people around. God bless you. You wrote about the field. First of all, you narrowed it down to five people who you think are the ones worth watching, and they are, let me see if I got these right, Biden, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris.
Yes.
And you observed this interesting. You talked about these candidates being broken down into three categories: normalcy, ambition, and aspiration.
Yes, I think that one of the things that we need to, you know, keep in mind about this sort of current makeup is that there, you know, the normalcy candidate is, you know, one that sort of speaks to a return to stability, to, right, you know, not having a White House that riles things up. The ambition candidates, from my perspective, are ones who basically say it's implicitly a rejection of the Obama presidency. And I think it will become actually more explicit as this election goes along,
right,
because he was insufficiently progressive. He did not, you know, keep in mind, think about how crazy it is. Everyone in this race other than Biden is running on some form of Medicare for all,
right,
rejecting Obamacare as being insufficient, et cetera, the signature domestic policy of the president. I would think that it would gain a little bit more notice if there was a different letter after their name. But that is sort of their core critique. And then I think there's the aspirational side when it comes to Mayor Pete, who is someone who sort of is this forward-looking kind of candidate for a more diverse, understanding of the kind of Americans who can make it. He has some of these traditional elements, but obviously being a gay married man from the Midwest who can sort of make people feel better about themselves, right. I think. What I think you saw, what you see traditionally in the Democratic Party is they like these young aspirational candidates, yes. And you see that in JFK, you see that in Bill Clinton, you see that in Barack Obama, and those are the types that they normally turn to. A lot of people in the media thought that Beto O'Rourke and Cory Booker would represent that kind of aspirational lane this time around. Right. And it's why both of those campaigns express such frustration at this stage about this mayor from South Bend kind of stealing what they thought of as their lane. I want to say, it just of those folks, obviously Bernie and Biden are well ahead of the others in terms of their most of the poll data and in terms of name ID, right. And in terms of money and that type of thing. That being said, I think that the closer that this party gets toward the ambition kind of side of things, and particularly the closer that they get to impeachment, I think that benefits Elizabeth Warren the most. Mm-hmm. And I think it benefits her because she has a large team of people who are ready to take advantage of any moment that rises.
Right.
And she has, I think, a very clear message that is in opposition to the elites, to banks. It seems more outsidery necessarily than it might be.
Right.
And that's something that allows people to have maybe the ambitions that they would get with a Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. but instead of getting it from a guy who has all the baggage associated with honeymooning in Russia and, right. Having the kind of Soviet history he does from his various broadcasts over the years, I think they could look to Warren as being a way to have perhaps a more direct path to the White House.
I think Elizabeth Warren, Ben, is like the Knicks on draft night, just praying to get the number one pick to get Zion, and she's praying to get a seat on the debate panel next to Joe Biden. That could be quite something if those two are on the same panel, because they do not like each other.
And
it goes back to the mid-2000s when she is testifying on Capitol Hill about the awfulness of banks, and Joe Biden is a senator from Delaware. It might as well be D-Big Banks. So they don't get along well. But let's talk a bit about Mayor Pete for a minute, because, yes, he is gay. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that is his. If you're looking for something different, that would be your feel-good vote, just mm-hmm. as maybe voting for Hillary makes you feel good about a woman, or Obama about someone who's a half African-American. So he would be the feel-good vote. But the way he is talking about his sexuality and the way he's putting it forward fascinates me. We're in California right now. And if our beloved Governor Gavin Newsom were running for president, boy, you better believe that front and center of the campaign, Ben, would be that I am the guy who fought for gay marriage. And people in my party hated me for doing it. And it's true, go back to 2004, the Democrats are ready just to burn him at the stake because they thought he cost him in Ohio. But Newsom would say that I fought the good fight. Mayor Pete, on the other hand, that yes, he is gay, but it's not a message about fighting for gay rights, about marching, about my partner and I going to four states trying to find a place to get marriage, and seeing the cover on Time Magazine, the American Gothic cover them. In other words, he's selling kind of the normalcy of the thing. It raises an interesting question within Democratic circles. Is he gay enough?
There's been a number of articles on this point, and we've published one that sort of responds to it from one of our gay contributors, Chad Green, which I think kind of came at this, which, there have been a number of articles at the Daily Beast and elsewhere that say some form of, well, does his experience really count? One of the lines in them, which I found particularly ridiculous, was at the end of the day, he's just another white, well-dressed man from the Midwest, mm-hmm. And that doesn't really count. In this sort of situation, there's a comment from Andrew Sullivan recently on when he was on the Fifth Column podcast, where he said, I used to be an HIV positive, vaguely Toryish, Catholic, neoconservative who read a lot of Oakeshott, and now I'm just another cis white man. And that to me is it says something. It actually says something positive about the experience of gay life in America, that you can have that kind of normalcy. But how quickly things turned from being a situation where this was talk about oppression and about marginalization to people viewing gay men through the lens of, well,
right.
they tend to be better educated. They tend to be more well off. They tend to have all of these other attributes that make them not fit within the intersectional conversation
yes.
in a way that they fit the Stacey Abrams view of identity politics. For Mayor Pete, I think that he's someone who will not end up the nominee, but could very well end up on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the reason that he could do that is because if you do look at the nature of his proposals, he lines up very much with what the elite sort of progressives want, the elite of the donor class want in terms right. of his actual agenda. But he also has kind of a winning personality and seems like someone who, while perhaps not ready to take the reins of the presidency, would be viewed as someone positive to deploy, particularly in debates against Mike Pence, which progressives would eat up, wanting to see a confrontation between the two of them. But this is obviously very early, and we can see a lot of these people having moments and having things go for them or against them. One thing that I will say, having now met Mayor Pete and seen him work a crowd in New Hampshire and talk to people up close, is it's a little bit of an issue for him how young he looks. He's kind of a slight person. He carries himself with a military bearing, but he's
37 or 38.
Yes,
I think. And youngish, almost ideable.
Yes, and what I think is going to be a little bit of a challenge for him is, however you think of their personalities, Cory Booker's a big guy, played football, obviously.
Right.
Beto O'Rourke is a big guy. Joe Biden carries himself in sort of an intimidating manner. If he's up on stage next to some of these folks, it could increase the likelihood that people view him as sort of a kid.
Right.
And I think that hurt Marco Rubio last time around, even mm-hmm. though he's older than Ted Cruz. He looks very young.
Right.
And it's one of these situations where I think that could potentially be a challenge for Mayor Pete that he'll have to overcome.
But we're getting way ahead of ourselves here, Ben. But if you're Joe Biden and if you manage to secure the Democratic nomination, how do you avoid not putting Kamala Harris on the ticket as your running mate?
I don't think you can. I think you have to. And I think that makes – I mean, in the same way that I could see Kamala picking Mayor Pete for a couple of different reasons. But it would be a situation where I think with someone like Biden at the top, you need – someone who fits this broader, agenda, for the party, as his running mate. One thing, though, that I think could be a problem for them in that circumstance is it actually would go to the president's thing that he's been beating Joe Biden up about to this point, which is the crime bill from the 90s,
yes.
He has clearly shown a willingness to use against Joe Biden. Kamala's reputation is as a law and order person. I will say that our next T-shirt at the Federalist, we like to make T-shirts here and there, is one that just says Kamala is a cop. so that's one of these things where I think the positioning, though, of the party, you need to pick someone who looks like the future. And Kamala, right. to a lot of people, looks like the future. In fact, I think the biggest question they have for her right now is she ready yet? And that also makes me wonder what Gavin Newsom thinks of this whole situation, given that if Kamala was to run and fail, he would seem to be ideally positioned to run in 2024.
Short answer, Ben, is that Gavin Newsom is in one of the weirdest positions in American politics right now. He is the king of California. I can't begin to imagine what he would do to get himself denied a second term. So here he runs the fifth largest economy in the world, governor of California, a wonderful position to be in for national politics. He spends his days trashing politics, Ben, and he spends his nights praying by his bed that Donald Trump gets reelected. Otherwise, Governor Newsom has to wait until 2028 to run, and that's a lifetime in politics and mm-hmm. a lifetime for his. You have an interesting quote on your Twitter account, Ben. It says, and I quote, "You can tell a man's vices by his friends, his virtues by his enemies."
So
who said that, and what's the point of that?
So that's a quote from my friend Dan McLaughlin, and he said it many years ago. And the reason it's always been something that has sort of stuck by me, and it's one that I embrace, is that I think it's very true in politics, and it's an indication of both the strengths and the weaknesses that people have around them. One of the things that I think you could say about the second Bush presidency in particular is that You know, what do we see in George W. Bush? I think you see a man who's very loyal, to his people, and sometimes I think that was the biggest aspect that hurt him. You know, the yes. people that he had chosen for various positions. You know, Donald Rumsfeld is one of the most brilliant men to ever work in government. He's also someone who should have left government earlier than he did. Yes. And I think that it was George W. Bush's personal loyalty to him that ended up being a major defect. I think similarly, you see that defect as it regards Michael Brown and FEMA and the reaction to Katrina. That personal loyalty winning out over what needed to be done. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to the current president, you can see his virtues by his enemies in all sorts of different ways. And I think it's one of the key reasons that people tend to back him and support him and have become more supportive of him within the right. coalition of the right over the past 2 years, because they've seen how crazy his enemies get and how willing they are to seize away, the rights of freedom of thought and to go after people who support even just aspects of his agenda as opposed to him personally. And so I think that's a lesson that applies to politics, it applies to life, and it right. says a lot about and who we are as people.
Right. You can tell a man's vices by his friends, his virtues by his enemies. I spent a good while Googling that, trying to figure out the author. I kept coming up with Ben Domenech, and I thought for sure the author would be John McCain. Because it sounds John McCain. And let's talk a bit about the late senator and his daughter. You are married to Meghan McCain.
Yes.
Almost 2 years now, right?
Yes. A couple more months, and then it'll be 2 years.
Okay. Yeah. What are you going to do for your anniversary?
We'll figure that out. I mean,
you guys both work like crazy. So
yes, we do. But we got married around Thanksgiving, and mm-hmm. This will be, this we're still in the first year since the senator's passing, and right. so what that means is sort of everything is a first. It's going to be the first July 4th, without him and that kind of thing, and so yeah. So it's still an emotional time for her, but it's also one where. We appreciate so much how much his legacy affects people, and appreciate folks who respected him regardless of their politics.
So I hope you saw the article. If you didn't, I'll send it on to you, and you can pass it on to her. It's about people who are now coming to the cemetery in Annapolis at the Naval Academy where the senator is interred, and they are leaving coins on his headstone. This is a military tradition. You leave pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters, depending on your relationship with the individual. So. McCain obviously just touched people's lives in ways that we can't begin to understand. And getting back to our talk about pathos and sweat equity, he is maybe our last true sweat equity presidential candidate, a man who served years in a POW camp. Nobody since then, and probably nobody for a long time, is going to have the same tale of hero that he had. But he also had kind of balanced it interestingly as well. It was part of the 2000 campaign, even more so in 2008. He was kind of... My sense was that he would talk about it, but he didn't necessarily want your pity out of it. He didn't really want it to be the reason to vote for him. He wanted to talk about other things in addition to where he spent the most years of his life.
Mm-hmm. I got to spend a lot of time with John over the past several years, and I asked him once, after he'd been diagnosed and we were up at the ranch, I think a couple months later.
Right.
And I asked him about, we didn't talk much about sort of his experience in captivity or coming out of it. But a question that I had for him was, did he ever have nightmares? And he sort of looked at me and said, no. And I said, really, really? That you didn't have any nightmares coming out of it or anything like that? And he said, no. And I don't know if he was telling the truth or not. I said, well, what's the like first thing that you sort of remember the night after you got out or something like that? And he said, well, they had to fly us to the Philippines. And I remember that we went to a restaurant and it was the best steak I ever had in my life. And so to a certain extent, what I think you can take away from the man is, and also, obviously so many people had so many experiences with him over the years.
Right.
I had, known him just as someone from green rooms and things like that in Washington before I met his daughter even. And one of the things that I think you can take away from him, in contrast to the sort of pathos that you talked about, mm-hmm. is, he wasn't a baby boomer. He was a silent generation guy. Mm-hmm. And because of that, he had a stoic attitude towards things that I think is profoundly absent in today's politics and among most of today's leaders. And I think stoicism is actually something that's very underrated in leadership.
Yeah.
And just being able to kind of confront things and take it and not have to engage in this grand emotional working out of things, you know, with going back to your point about not wanting anybody's sympathy, you know, he, to a certain extent, he was surrounded by people who were more eager to tell his story than he was. He didn't want to seem as being someone who was boastful for what he endured.
Right.
And I think that that's something that, you know, carried him through a lot of life. He's obviously someone who, you know, owned his mistakes, you know, when it came to various things, you know, whether you're talking about King right. Five or, you know, other aspects. And that certainly affected a lot of his policies. Personally, you know, I am far more libertarian than John ever was in a lot of different respects.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always a pleasure to argue with him and to go back and forth. And he did call me a jerk on national TV, which is his sign of affection.
Yes.
So.
Yes. I wrote some speeches for him in his 2000 campaign. I wrote some jokes for a roast that he did, which was one of the highlights of my writing.
Was that experience.
It was a Don Imus roast.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. And actually, I came up with kind of the perfect joke for it. He was in front. This is when McCain is getting ready to run for president.
Mm-hmm.
And Mitch McConnell just... On one hand, McConnell may vote for him for president just to get him out of the chamber. He's just so tired of McCain and campaign finance. And the joke was this. Actually, I'd found on the Imus website, MSNBC, they had an Imus question, which was, well, you know, when McCain runs for president, will Imus stick with him to the bitter end or drop him like a bad habit? And I looked at the result. It's like a 3-1 margin will drop him like a bad habit. So the joke wrote itself. I don't know how long it took Mitch McConnell to click on that site 400 times. It was just a very good DC joke, and the crowd erupted, and just he told it very well. But
If I can interject, I was listening recently to a conversation between Conan O'Brien and Patton Oswalt. And Oswalt said in passing, you know, that he had attended, I guess, the New York roast that they have where everybody's in white ties and tails. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but
is it the Friars Club?
It's like the traditional one that all the presidential candidates, you know, go to right before the election.
Oh, not the Columbus Day dinner. It's Knights of Columbus.
Yes, yeah. Knights of Columbus. KFC. Yes, he said that. You know, I could tell that Obama was going to win at that juncture because his jokes all sucked and McCain's were hilarious. And he says, you know, it's always the guy who's funnier who's going
to
lose.
Yeah, I listened to Conan O'Brien's podcast too. It's brilliant stuff. The one Bob Newhart just did was fantastic.
Bob's joke delivery is still just amazing. Just fantastic.
Yeah. Let's talk about two other comedians, Seth Meyers.
Yes, so I got into it a little bit.
Explain to the audience what happened here.
So,
Seth is the host of NBC late.
Yeah.
Night, right?
So first off, let me say, even before I was dating my wife, I have for years hated Seth Meyers. I cannot stand him.
Really?
I just find him extremely irritating, and it's both through some personal interaction, but also through
what Weekend Update.
I would just say this. I think that it is a true sign of sort of – if there was a sign that there's a real problem with untalented people getting ahead because of who they know, mm-hmm. it's to look at the list of people that we have out there who are hilarious comedians who would be so much better at hosting that show than he is. His show does not do well. It gets 1.2 million people on a good night in terms of its viewership. And just to put that in perspective, Greg Gutfeld routinely beats it with his show,
yeah.
Which is on cable, obviously, not broadcast. But it's one of the things where I just have disliked, and you can find the tweets on this saying, you know, like mm-hmm. another unfunny joke from Seth Meyers, that kind of thing.
Right.
He had my wife on recently to purportedly talk about things that were totally unrelated to politics. It was supposed to be kind of a soft, you know, interview type thing. And instead, he very aggressively kind of went after her on comments that she's made about Ilhan Omar, comments that have resulted in highlighting Ilhan Omar's anti-Semitic, you know, sort of things that she's said in a number of different occasions, and connected, frankly, with the anti-Semitic statements done by the Women's March, which have resulted in numerous death threats and all sorts of really, you know, like the nasty, some of the nastiest stuff I've seen in my life. I've never seen anything close to the kind of death threats that one receives when you start going out there and really confronting some of these left of center folks on their anti-Semitic views. Mm-hmm. Myers had an aggressive interview with her. I had a conversation with my wife about it, and I went on a rant about Seth Meyers, in which I said some intemperate things. It did, I think, express my honest views on the subject, which is that he's someone who only has the job that he does because of how much he's sucked up over the years to Lorne Michaels, and that, obviously he was the former head writer at SNL, and I think he was one of their weakest head writers. But it's one of the things where, you know, I raged at him a bit. The next week, he had on both Rashida Tlaib, who had ended up coming on, the congresswoman ended up coming on immediately after comments were publicized, in which she talked about her warm feelings associated with the post-Holocaust experience of the Jews, and had this completely ahistorical thing in which he gave her all this time to sort of defend herself without challenging any of the very ahistorical things that she said on the program. And he followed it up by bringing A.D. Bryant on, who had portrayed my wife on SNL in their sketch On The View, in which she said some denigrating things about their experience in high school. They went to the same high school in Arizona. And the perspective that I have on it, frankly, is just that basically what he did over the coming week vindicated a lot of what I think of him, which is very low. The truth is that within this industry, there's an understanding within various sort of contexts of there's some things that are soft and there's some things that are hard. And if you're going to have a hard-edged interview about something, if you're going to have somebody come on, take the time to come from a different network to be on your show, that if you're going to have something that's a little bit more confrontational or something like that, there's a clearinghouse for that. It's basically just saying, hey, I'm going to talk to you about something. It's not a gotcha. And this is what, you know, sort of the direction we're going. And to me, you know, I think that if you want to have an interview like that, you know the context of it. You know that they're going to be, you know, there's a difference in when you go and are on with a serious interviewer who you know has a reputation for asking serious questions versus someone who just, you know, says that they're going to, you know, stick to softer subjects or something along those lines, and that the rules are kind of different within that space. I know that's a very, you know, that may be an old-fashioned perspective now, that a lot of these late-night shows have turned to more aggression. Right. But the point is that if someone goes on with Jimmy Fallon, they're expecting to, you know, they're expecting to sing about the news or to engage in some kind of contest, you know, and it's just a little bit different in the current context when a lot of these late night shows have felt the need to get so much more aggressive. So that's a long way of answering your question, but that's essentially my perspective on what happened.
But now John Oliver has joined in as well.
Yes, John Oliver trolled us apparently in his episode. Yes. You know what was so funny about that is it took a whole day for me to find out about it. Like, no, I'm very serious. We didn't get any emails or comments or anything like that, and it took like a whole day for me to hear anything about it. My only explanation for that is that he barely gets a million viewers, and it was the same night as I think Game of Thrones, so people were a lot more focused in talking about what happened there than they were about a John Oliver sort of comment.
That's funny. So you mentioned that you talked to Megan before you commented about Seth Meyers.
Yes.
Right. So she got her sign off saying, "I want to."
Oh no, I didn't get her sign off.
Oh,
that's
you didn't.
No. I should say we don't sign off on each other's tweets.
You don't. Okay. So
we speak for ourselves, I should say, and our views are very different when it comes to politics. So
then, what are the rules or the unwritten rules for commenting on what your wife is doing?
Oh, that's a good question. I think we're still figuring that out.
For example, she's on The View.
Yeah.
So The View was on here about an hour ago, so Lord knows what happened on The View today. Given any week, she could be attacked by anybody.
I think they were preempted today because of Mueller.
Mueller, yes. Okay, yeah, bigfooted them. But, you know, a week goes by, and eventually she's going to get attacked. Just sitting at the end of that table, it's going to be her turn to get the abuse.
Oh, yes, it's every day.
But you sit there as her spouse. I mean, at what point do you think, I want to say something to Whoopi Goldberg, or Joy Behar is probably the culprit here, but how do you decide whether or not to weigh in?
So, first off, I would say I just make it a policy of not criticizing her you know, her ABC co-hosts generally. I will say that I think the only one who I've criticized repeatedly over the years is actually Anna Navarro, who, you know, I have criticized for a lot of different reasons, and she's obviously on CNN and not typically.
So Anna was a former Jeb Bush aide who kind of started on cable for Republican presence, but has just gone off into the wild.
Never Trump. Yeah, but more than that, I just think that she, you know, I don't think she's a very serious political analyst, and I don't take her views very seriously.
Google her and Michael Avenatti. See what quote you come up with.
Yeah, well, the thing that I will just say is that I actually don't criticize these people, and mostly because I think they're actually, for the most part, very professional. I think that, you know, the Whoopi Goldberg, I think, does a great job and is really good at running that table. In fact, SNL actually, I think, had a good joke about that in their first iteration of it, which was, I'm Whoopi Goldberg, and I'm surprised that I'm so good at this. but here's the truth. Within this industry, everyone to a certain extent knows that when you're on TV, when you're in these moments, and when you're on shows like this, it's partially real and partially a performance, and that that people sort of take things up to 11 that maybe they don't say when they're behind the scenes. That's, you know, sometimes that's true, sometimes that isn't. But my view is just this: I sometimes, for the most part, I try to restrain myself, and occasionally something goes too far, and then it gets under my skin, and then that's when I say something that you know, might offend or might be too rude. One thing, though, that I do think is important is being factually accurate on these sort of popular daytime shows as they become more political. Yes. And I would include this in the whole swath of them. You know, it's all the more important that the facts that are presented are serious and that they deal with the issues at hand in a serious manner. One issue that obviously Megan likes to talk about, well, she doesn't like to talk about it, but she has to talk about it a lot, is the issue of abortion. She's probably, I would argue, the most prominent pro-life woman on daytime TV today, certainly in the amount of time she spends talking about the issue. She recently got an award from America's United for Life because of that. And one of the things that I think comes with that territory is a heck of a lot of gaslighting and misinformation, particularly when it comes to the laws currently being debated in the states, what they do and how they impact things. And one of the, you know, real challenges, I think, is that when the media comes to reporting about this issue, it is very frequently inaccurate in the way that they both describe what the current law allows, you know, what courts are deciding, and they do so in ways that are really irresponsible and don't speak to the issue as well. I mean, you know, if you look across the media, you know, poll data actually tells us that American women are more opposed to abortion than American men, and it actually shows that American women overwhelmingly favor limits on abortion that would bring us more in line with the experience in Europe, where we have limits that they have limits typically at 14 to 16 weeks. There's overwhelming support for limits at 20 weeks in America. And yet from the depiction of the media and the way that they treat the representatives of Planned Parenthood and a number of other, you know, organizations that want essentially unrestricted abortion, you would think that this was this binary issue where it's only men who are in favor of any kind of restriction and it's all women who are standing up and are under assault if there's any restriction considered. And so, you know, Megan pushes back against that a lot. And I certainly appreciate that, just as so many other pro-lifers do.
Very interesting. What if Donald Trump might drop the mic, said, I'm out of here in 2020? What if Donald Trump loses the 2020 election? What is this world of politics going to do without Donald Trump?
So if he loses this election, first off, there's no way. People who've said he's going to walk away, he loves campaigning more than he loves anything else. He wishes he could always be campaigning.
I've struggled with this for a while. When he was first elected, I struggled from the beginning of this. We can get into that another day. From the first time he got that escalator, it's been almost 4 years now. It'll be 4 years and a couple weeks now. I still can't over the fact this guy ran, much less won. I don't know about you, when I see the State of the Union and the sergeant comes out and says, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States, then you see Donald Trump, it's, what? But so I thought for a while, Ben, that maybe he would be James K. Polk, that he would, if he could get some progress on immigration, the economy is doing well, he gets a foreign policy achievement, he gets a couple of Supreme Court justices, drops a mic and says, I'm out of here. And given his age and he's got other things going on in his life, it all makes sense. But I think you raise a good point. Trump likes to run, if for no better reason than to prove that the smart people are wrong.
Yeah.
So the smart money said in 2016 he can't get elected. going to run, show them they're wrong. And I think the smart money says he won't get reelected, so try to prove him again wrong. So I assume he said, but no, Ben, this whole world of media and punditocracy around Trump and everybody who's profiting off this, the New York Times, CNN, in terms of ratings and subscriptions, all the talk, all the hot air around Trump, where does it all go if he disappears?
You know, it's funny because there's this, we have this whole frame of the media as being, as hating Trump. And certainly they are antagonistic to him, and he is antagonistic to them. But it's a mutually beneficial relationship. It's one that he really profits from because he knows that the media is, frankly, less popular than he is.
Right.
And that the you know, in a certain sense, you know, this is all wrestling for him. This is all WWE. The issue with I think it will actually be very bad for the media for Donald Trump to stop being president. It's been great for the New York Times and pretty good for the Washington Post. What is going to be interesting, I think, is if he is reelected, there's all sorts of challenges that I think the media would face in terms of figuring out what's next and in terms of figuring out how to deal with kind of being having their view rejected so definitively, you know, not just in a surprise incident in 2016,
right.
But in something that I think we could see happening coming in 2020. I already hear, you know, prognosticators in green rooms will tell you that right now things favor his reelection, and those are the honest ones, those are the fair ones, those are the ones who aren't, you know, strongly partisan, and that's. To me, you know, something that has become kind of conventional wisdom, for that to change and what that does to the media industry and to politics generally, I think the biggest thing that it changes is it sort of it shuts the door on the idea that this was that his sort of approach was fundamentally transformational. It instead turns Trump into a transitional figure that you have to kind of pick over historically and say, well, he did this one thing and he was successful in part because the other candidate was so disliked and made so many mistakes. And he sort of fell into this as if, you know, he's Kramer from Seinfeld or something like that. The difference there is if he is reelected, I think it's hard for him not to be viewed as transformational because he – look, you know, one of the things that I've said before in other contexts is that the one thing that we know about the 2012 autopsy that was true is that it was about a party that was dead.
Right.
And that Donald Trump essentially took over that party because of that death and was able to remake the coalition in some interesting ways, both in the primary and in the general. And one of the things that, you know, comes out of that is figuring out what comes next. Obviously, he's older and he's, you know, he can only be president for so long and – I have no idea what he'll do when he steps away other than golf and make comments and that kind of thing. But it is interesting to see the emerging debate within the right about what comes next, what that looks like. And I think some of the key figures there are some of the people who were most recently elected. I think Rick Scott in Florida and Josh Hawley from Missouri are both people who are ambitious. I think that you can look at someone as ambitious as Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas and sort of you can see some of these emerging strains of, okay, how do we figure out what comes next and what that looks like in terms of a center-right coalition and what its key aspects are?
That is my final question. It is election night 2020, and regardless of the results, Republicans are going to come forward and quickly because Trump wins. He's instantly a lame duck if he loses. Nomination's over for 2024. Who would you look for on that stage in terms of that person trying to get on TV the most, someone trying to put themselves front and center as the next big deal?
You know, obviously everybody's already, you know, thinking about things as being kind of a Nikki Haley, Mike Pence contest, you know, for 2020. But I don't think that either of them are actually likely to become the nominee for a couple of different reasons. I think it's a lot more likely that we see someone who's a newer face emerge on the right. Mm-hmm. And that could come from a lot of different corners. It could, you know, there are a number of Republican governors out there who, you know, could potentially do things. But I think we could also see some attempted comebacks. I mean, the truth is that Paul Ryan's a very young guy, and he has a lot of different options open to him. Who knows what he'll end up doing? And within the Senate right now, some of the most interesting people, you know, are these younger folks. Just to go back to Senator Hawley for a minute, he's someone who is the youngest member of the Senate. He's the first millennial in the Senate, and he's someone who I think is already saying things about technology, about the direction of the culture and the ability of parents to sort of protect their children, and a number of other statements that to me look like an attempt to blend sort of the nationalism that Trump represents with perhaps a more skeptical of business attitude within the Republican coalition, with sort of a traditional conservatism of the family and of the neighborhood that has a lot of potential to shake things up in terms of the way that people think about politics going forward.
How about a McCain-Domenech ticket? Domenech-McCain.
No. I leave politics to the people who have the stomach for it. I'm happy to stay in media and to cover all the folks who are willing to put their hat in the ring. It's a very brave thing to go out there and to withstand the slings and arrows of everyone around you. And frankly, I think you have to have the temperament for it, which is something that is very demanding. And frankly, you can't take a vacation from just about anything. You have to be always on when it comes to that kind of leadership. I appreciate those who do get in that ring, though.
Okay. Ben Domenech, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us, and tell your friends about us. Get them to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover's fellows straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Ben Domenech is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at BDOMENECH. That's how you pronounce spell out Domenech. At B Domenech is his Twitter handle. The Federalist you can find online at www.thefederalist.com. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.